Okay, so this is Suzanne Snyder. I'm here with Orla Reedy on June 23rd, 2020, as part of a project around education narratives and experiences of educators in the age of COVID-19. And I should state for anyone listening that this is a remote interview and I'm in Hudson, New York. And Orla, I wondered if we could start with you introducing yourself, please.
Hello, my name is Orla Reedy. I'm a secondary school teacher in Kildare in Ireland. So,
thank you. Yeah. So I'm excited to hear about an educational landscape that's not adjacent to my own geographic location. Before we get to the subject of the last 3 months, I wondered if you could tell me a little bit about where you come from.
Well, I originally come from Cork, so we'd be quite tribal. So I come from Cork. We moved to Kildare 25 years ago. I am married to another educator in the third level sector and have two sons who are both in third level. So, yeah, so we've been here. We moved to Kildare when the oldest boy was a few months old. So we're here nearly 25 years.
And for someone not familiar with the educational system in Ireland, third level, what does that mean in terms of age?
Age would be from about 18 to PhD.
Thank you. And can you tell me growing up a little bit about your own experience in terms of education as a learner?
Both primary schools, it would have been traditional in, was a small city, a big city in Ireland, small city in the rest, in the global sense. But usually, unless you were from a smaller area, schools were segregated, boys and girls. So I went to both primary and secondary school were for all girls. All girls, Catholic schools. Both of them, primary and secondary, and I have taught in a number of sectors. We have different sectors in Ireland. We have what I'm in now, and what I've been mostly in is a voluntary, what's called a voluntary secondary school. So they are generally coming out of religious orders. So we would have nuns who would have set up, the Mercy Order nuns or the Presentation nuns might have set up schools. They would also have set up hospitals. So they have a very strong tradition of educating, particularly girls in secondary education and primary education. And then you would have your community schools, now known as the Educational Training Boards, and they would be non-sectarian, and mostly mixed. But would be, I suppose, where the voluntary secondary schools traditionally would have been moving more towards academics. The ETBs traditionally, not anymore, but traditionally would have been going towards, you know, apprenticeships, etc., that kind of education. But that's not the case anymore.
So, how do you regard your own early experience as a learner and in response to your teachers?
Excellent. The primary school that I went to was a new school. And so while it was steeped in kind of the traditions of Ireland, of Irish education, it was extremely progressive. You know, I suppose we had mostly newly qualified teachers who had the latest methodologies, etc. So I, from a very early age, I suppose, I was exposed to not experimentation, but experimentation with good academic grounding, you know, in teaching. And I suppose learning to, that education is for education, not just completely exam driven, you know, that there is a holistic view of education. So that would be my big takeaway, I suppose, from a lot of it.
And would you, just again, for someone not familiar with the educational landscape, which I'm sure is very complex, but are there any sort of leading philosophies or schools of thought in terms of education that have been relevant or influential for you?
Very much in the Irish education system, there is a completely holistic view of education. So we look at what we would call the mind, body, and spirit. and that is across all sectors. So all schools will have your academic, your subjects, which is extremely broad in Ireland. So we'll say our school leavers will study for exam seven subjects, you know, and go into quite a lot of detail in those seven subjects. Then we have the mind. We have that's your mind, your body. It is compulsory to have physical education classes for everybody every week. It's absolutely compulsory, and there is no getting out of it. There is, you know, and then spirit, we have got, traditionally we would have had religion classes. All schools would have had some kind of religion, and that would be religious education. Yes, before now, and even in my own school, it would be based on the Catholic ethos, or, you know, the different ethos of this, of the governing body of the school. But now there has been introduced in a junior cycle, so students from about 12 to 15 are now have to have, over their 3 years, 400 hours of well-being. So that can include mindfulness, choir classes, that kind of thing. So it's kind of the whole well-being of the whole self, as well as the academics. So that's hugely progressive.
And I know there are certain educational leaders who have had international influence. So this might not be relegated to one country, but are there any leaders in education in Ireland that are of note for you or your colleagues?
Irish educators or international educators?
Well, both. I'm interested in figures.
Well, at the minute, one of the people that I'm following at the minute would be a person called Dr. Aidan Clerken. And he's done a huge study on the year we have in schools, which is called transition year. Okay, so that's a year between the junior school and the senior school. And it is like a gap year or a year out of academics, even though there is some academic input. However, they get to experience work shadowing, community service, etc., etc. So there's a gap, very wide range. And because I'm program coordinator in my school, I'm very interested in his studies. So he would be an influencer, if you like. We have the American, you know, we have Dylan William, we have Andy Hargreaves. I suppose Ciarán Sugrue would be another huge influencer. He's an Irish academic here who would have huge influence on leadership and change. And we've had huge educational change in Ireland. I suppose internationally, really, but really in Ireland, we've had huge international curricular change. So, you know, we're looking at these people a lot.
Thank you. That's really helpful. And I think I have one more question before we get to the more present moment, which is, how would you narrate your path to becoming an educator?
I was born wanting to do it. I really wanted to be a teacher, and I absolutely love my job. It is. And I was talking to one of my friends and colleagues earlier this morning, and we realized that with the COVID lockdown, it has really been made very clear to us that it's in the school and among the students is where we want to be, not on a screen with our students, but actually in communicating with them personally. So, yeah.
I want to hear more about that in detail, and I knew that I had a little bit of text from you. This is the first time we're interacting, but about your concerns about educating through the screen, and I appreciate you jumping on a screen in order to record this, but maybe we can shift into these last 3 months, and I wondered if I could start you with maybe some memories about when and how COVID sort of precautions, or when COVID began to interfere or enter into even your educational space. And you know what? Before you do that, maybe you could talk to me about your educational space.
Okay, so as I say, I am program coordinator in the school. And what this entails is I oversee aspects of this transition year. Okay, so one of the things would be that the girls get an opportunity to try different subjects, different courses in the universities. I had one girl on a chemistry course in Trinity College, and I got an email from the college saying that they had COVID on campus and they were closing some of the buildings. So that was the first, I suppose, interaction that I had with COVID. And the other interactions then were that the girls go on work shadowing or community service, which means that community service is when they go to places like retirement homes and they, you know, maybe help out or entertain the residents. And again, I got an email to say that they couldn't go any longer because they at risk of bringing COVID into the retirement homes. So I suppose that was the first thing. Then we had our school musical in the first week in March, and the following Thursday, our Taoiseach announced that schools were closing. So it was very fast and very sudden. You know, it was surreal because the students were asked to take their books and go home. And they were leaving the school, not just with their school bags, but with black plastic bags. And so, you know, kind of refuse bags. So that meant that, you know, there was a complete evacuation, an emptying of the school, you know, and it wasn't a happy one, like the Christmas holidays or the summer holidays where everybody's waving goodbye and happy and, you know, whatever. It was quiet and it was subdued. It wasn't excited to be released into the community, you know, or into holidays. So it was a bit surreal.
Do you remember what the date was that everyone went home with their bags?
12th of March.
And how was it announced to your students? What was happening?
Our deputy principal, we were in a funny position in that our principal had resigned because she was seconded to another area, and so we were between principals. So we have three deputy principals. There's over 1,000 in the school, so we have three deputy principals. So one of the deputy principals came on the intercom to announce it to the whole school at the time, and I had three barristers in doing a law course with some of my students as well, so that was all very weird.
And just to, again, widen the frame for a moment, mm-hmm. Could you define who your learners are in terms of age and gender and any other identity categories that would be helpful to understand, like class, you know, accessibility to the school?
We have, it's an all-girls Catholic school. However, we take all girls from the community. So anybody who applies, it doesn't matter whether you're Catholic. You know, we have actually in Ireland, there is a huge uptake of Muslim girls into Catholic single sex schools because they're single sex schools. So it suits a Muslim traditional families to have just girls in a school. So we take all girls. There is an entrance exam, but it is only for CAT scores. It's, you know, for tracking. It's not for academics. So everybody who applies, really, if you're eligible, you get in. So there would be a huge academic push in the school and expectation. However, all students, regardless of their academic ability, are catered for, you know, and very, very, very well. And given extra help, extra support. At the time, we have got 2 years for exams, for state exams. One is junior cycle, so students would be about 15. Low stakes, but one is senior cycle, 6 years. And that, your results for that solely go towards your college entry. We have a college entry point system here, whereby if your grades, we have H1, H2. So a H1 is 90 to 100 marks, and you will get 96 points, I think. Well, 100 points. And then, you know, if you're looking, you take your six best subjects and you put those together. So it's a high stakes exam. You know, they don't go to college from continuous assessment or interview or personal statements. There is nothing like that. It is solely based on the few weeks of the Leaving Cert. So that was a huge concern for them, because they were thrown into complete limbo. Because initially we were told we'd be back in 3 weeks. So we could prepare them, you know, to revise and give work for and a bit of progression for 3 weeks, but it continued, you know, so there was huge, huge shift and change in Ireland at that time.
So when do those tests normally happen?
No, June. They should be finishing this week. So what happened was, it's unprecedented. The thing about the Leaving Cert is we don't grade our own students. They are completely anonymous. They are a number only. And they sit the exams. Yes, they sit them in the school, but with an exam number. And they are sent externally to Department of Education markers, teachers. But, you know, that this is extra work that they take. So we had that. The students have got an oral or a practical component to their work, which usually happens in March, April. So, for example, I teach Irish language and literature. The Irish oral should have happened in March, should have been 40% of their overall result. And very quickly, the Minister for Education said that the oral wouldn't happen, but that everybody would get 40%. Okay. So they still had their own, you know, they had their fair, you know, level playing ground for when they did their written work. Then that changed, and they said that they would have exams. They usually would have them from after the bank holiday weekend in June, first week in June, so to the end of June. Excuse me. So that changed. They were now going to have them in end of July and August, and teachers were going to come in to the students for July, you know, for at least 3 weeks before their exams, bring them back up to the level they should be at. Then that changed. And what we have never, ever done before is we had to estimate grades for our own students. And submit them to our schools. So that was tough.
Can you say a little more about how that works? Just maybe walk us through an example of what you were tasked with doing.
Well, what we had to do was look back over our records of where our students had started with us. So if I took somebody in at the beginning of, we call them fifth and sixth year. So if I had somebody at the beginning of fifth year, well, what was her performance then? What was her work input? How was she improving? What the trajectory would be then for her grade compared to my records? So it was tough, because we also had to rank our students. Now, as language teachers, we generally rank them anyway because of the oral, in case there's a discrepancy between the oral result and the written work. So we're used to that. However, if you're teaching something else where you're not ranking your students, they're just all going into an exam on a day on their own. You're not used to doing that. So you had to take everything into consideration. You had to also take into consideration some of the work that the work that they had inputted, you know, from March. However, you had to keep in mind that not every child or student had access to technology. You know, not every student will have a laptop at home. Not every student, you know, we would have girls who mightn't have internet at home. You know, that they might have a phone, yes, but maybe not have internet. So, you know, all of these things had to be taken into consideration. So nobody could be penalized for not sending in work. However, you were supposed to take into consideration also the work that was being sent in. So again, I suppose I'm doing it long enough. I know who has engaged fully with me from the very beginning and who is delighted not to be able to engage, you know. And I'd have to say that I had a spectacularly strong class this year. And that was a huge concern I had, was that they would not, because what happened after, what happens now that we have inputted, they're put into a bell curve, a national bell curve. So where they might have had a fighting chance before this, they will now be bell curved, which, you know, you hope that they will be as strong as they should be. That's the concern.
You started to answer the question I was going to ask you next, which is, if you could, I think I'm understanding some of the implications of this plan, but would you mind really spelling it out, in your opinion, what are the implications for both teachers and students with this contingency plan? How does it impact teachers and students in terms of labor and responsibility?
Labor as in the work that we had to do?
The new work,
it was huge. When so much emphasis has been put on formative assessment and formative feedback. And that is the model. And I suppose we're coming back maybe to Dylan William with that, you know, that we are giving good feedback as much as we can, that's very formative. And so I suppose the shift has been, rather than just grade a student, we are giving them feedback to work on, which works very, very well if you're in a classroom situation where you can follow through, you can say to a student, I said this in your last essay, did you do this? You know, so you can have that personal follow on. So the grading, to be honest, I suppose because of that, because I was so focused on that, I would know where my students' weak points would be or strengths would be. And yes, I would have always have had an eye on the grade, but not to the same extent as I would have had before. So when it came then to taking out the files and looking through everything and you know, being very forensic about it, really, because it, like that, you want to be as fair as you possibly can to everybody. Because yes, the tops will get the top, but if the tops are brought down, then the bottoms are being brought down as well. You know, so you have to make sure that everybody gets their just case put before the boards, you know. So it was very, very tough. And then the students, when it was announced, we had been in class with the students, so we'd done online classes with students and had kept in contact with them. And sometimes the classes would go on a little bit longer because they didn't want to sign off. They just wanted to chat at the end like they would. But when it was announced, we weren't allowed to have any contact with them. And they weren't allowed to contact us. And that is, you know, you realize more and more how important your support as a teacher is for your students. Yes, of course, you're doing the academics, but that's not the full job, you know, especially when there are students who, as I said, their whole college experience rests on this exam. And you want them to know that, of course, you are going to take, they know us, but, you know, you want to reassure them that you are going to take this very seriously and that you are going to do your very level best to be as fair and as transparent as you possibly can be, you know.
So just to understand this significant rupture in communication, how much time, you know, this was announced that you would now be the gatekeeper, essentially.
Yeah.
And then over what time were you given to do this work, and over what time did you have to be out of contact with your students?
I would say we were given about 3 weeks to do it, and we were not allowed to contact them for about a month in total. We weren't in contact with them, I'd say from the middle of May.
Was that the end of the school year, or would you have been?
No, they would have stayed on. You see, what happens is they finish school, but they would come into school to study. and they would still have access to us to hand up exercises or essays or that until the 2nd of June, you know, so they would still be in the school and have access to us until then.
So just to make extra clear, there was no exam. You were using the existing work prior to quarantine and some of the work that was submitted during quarantine, which was...
You see, you had to take into consideration, they do have what we call pre-exams or a mock exam. So they did that in February. But at the time, some girls were studying for the HPAT for college entry for medicine. So mightn't have put quite the amount of time, effort and energy into their pre-exams that they would have for their real thing. So we're making up the time. And so sending me in work, you know, 3 or 4 essays out of nowhere, extra to what I was setting, just to make up the deficit. So you have to take that effort into consideration as well, to be fair, while not penalizing the girls who couldn't. You know.
When that interval was over, what happened?
They were only inputted yesterday. The department only closed its inputting yesterday. So we had to fill a form for each student. We had to grade her and sign off on all the work. And, you know, the form had, you know, based on that, our estimate was based on her ability, her engagement with the work, her improvement, you know, that kind of thing. So we had to sign off on all of that. But of course, then you also have to sign a disclaimer that you don't have a conflict of interest. So, you know, and I would do that. You have to do that even if you're correcting exams for the state. You know, if you're related to anybody or if your next door neighbor is doing, you have to sign off that you might have a conflict of interest. So it is anonymized as far as possible.
Is that possible to not have a conflict of interest with your own cohort and learners?
It is. I think it is, you know, because I suppose I've been lucky in that I work for the department delivering in service for English teachers on a part-time basis. And I have also been on a quality assurance panel with the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment. So I suppose I have a very good stand back position for my students. And that was the hard part, that you are separating, you know, the students who you knew body, heart and soul were trying so hard and you knew the courses that they were looking for, but you still had to give them. Again, you're looking at the people at the top and you're looking at the people at the end of the list. And you had to be fair to everybody. So yeah, you're their best advocates, but at the same time, the professionalism has to come into play as well. You know, you do have to stand back and you do have to stand over everything. And, you know, I suppose the principal signs off on all of these grades. And if there are any outliers where I think that, you know, well, she's a lovely girl and she's worked really hard, so we'll give her a good mark. But if that doesn't tally with the rest of her subjects, then I would have been asked to maybe look at it again or maybe revise or, you know, kind of show proof of what I estimated. But that hasn't happened.
So what will happen with all of your students now that you did that inputting yesterday? What happens now?
Nothing. They don't know what I've inputted. They won't know what I've inputted ever. The only appeal that can be made is to look at the inputting. So the actual transfer of what I have on my sheet into the department. That's the only appeal that can be made. And I hope that, as I say, when the bell curve happens, that they will get what they should get. As I say, they were just a particularly strong class this year that I had.
How do you create an end of year, or is that something that already happened or will happen?
We had a Zoom assembly, a graduation ceremony with them. So again, it's Catholic school. So we started with a prayer service and all the girls were on Zoom with all teachers. And we could see them, you know, the way you can flash across the screens, and we could see them there with their families, and there were balloons, and it was as good as it could ever be under the circumstances. So they did their readings. The head girl and deputy head girl gave amazing speeches, amazing speeches. And the acting principal gave an amazing speech. And, it really was lovely. Before that, they'd had assemblies with their year head and deputy principal who over 6 years. So, they weren't just let go on the 12th of March and, keep in touch when you get your college place. It wasn't like that. So there will be something also in September, October, we'll have some kind of ceremony for them as well, some kind of an award ceremony or something like that to bring them together.
That's one of the things I want to make sure we're collecting from all educators who are participating. Before I ask you to describe your own experience, how would you describe what happened after March 12th? We know they left with the garbage bags. What happened next?
What happened then is they were told before they gathered their belongings that we would be working from teams and groups. We're a Microsoft school, so we worked from teams and groups, so that was very useful. They could always contact us by email as well. We all have our school email. They contact us with the school email. So work can be set. I don't know if you're familiar with setting work on Teams, but it's very useful. Work can be set on Teams, as in class assignments. You can set up a class group on set assignments and you can see the assignments coming in and correct them and give feedback as you have them, which is terrific. And then groups can work the same. That is just where you have your class in a group and they email work into you and you just put it into the group and you work from there.
So you're using almost the digital form of like a correspondence course. Was there delivery like this? Was there remote Zoom-based education or seeing each other at all?
Towards the end, when all of the policies, you see, we wouldn't have had this. I would not have been in contact with my students outside of school time. I would not have had, we wouldn't have been used to calling or anything like that. So policies had to be drawn up pretty quickly on safe internet use. Well, we had safe internet use, but on calls, on classes. So that was drawn up. And then once that was done, yes, we could have this kind of communication with our students. It started off slowly with them without their videos on. They couldn't record. One of the things was that the teacher was always the last to leave the meeting. So the teacher set up the meeting and was the last to leave. That could take some time sometimes.
Were all these protocols drawn from sort of national level or regional?
Local,
so school by school or systems of schools?
No, school by school. Now, there would have been consultation. There would have been recommendations maybe by department and by the governing body, CESHT, of our school. But it is on a school by school basis that all policies and procedures are drawn up.
And can you tell me, what you learned over the last 3 months before we get to the future? I just want to really go back over these 3 months. What has this been like for you and what have you learned? And that could be really about anything, about technology, about yourself, about education. What has this been like and what did you learn?
Well, it's been isolating because so many conversations happen over the photocopier. You know, even those kind of little hints and tips, or I suppose people learn from people. You know, you can learn so much by technologies or by Zoom or by webinars, etc. But people basically learn from people. I always maintain that when we go to in-service, we learn as much at the coffee break as we do at the seminars. I found I had to upskill. I was fairly good. I'm a fairly early adapter. However, I found I had to upskill on assignments, etc., on Teams, and work my way around different things like that. I can do PowerPoints, etc. I have recorded, but I've only done voice recording. I haven't recorded video yet to share with my students, but I have done voice recording of core pieces for the Oral Irish. I have learned I miss the classroom. I have learned, well, what I always knew, but it has been reinforced for me, is that there is more to teaching than academics. That has been huge, and that is something that if I didn't have the day-by-day interaction with the students, I don't think I would do this. I would not be. I like technology, but not as much as this. I feel too maybe that there are students who might fall through cracks pastoral care wise. I feel that very strongly because, you know, the way our school works is we're based in a classroom, so I'm in the one classroom all of the time. Students come to me. And you can see the demeanor of students as they come in or as they leave, you know, and sometimes they might hang back and have something to say, whereas now that interaction is gone completely. And that, you know, you're not in a position where you can support. I'm not a guidance counsellor, I'm not a counsellor, but I suppose I'm old enough now that they would nearly see me like a mother. You know, hopefully not grandmother yet, but a mother at least, and that I can point them in the right direction if I feel, or I can alert somebody else to a behaviour that I think might be not usual. And I suppose that's really where I come from. I also miss the joy. I mean, you can have great banter, you know, you can have great fun in a classroom. There is no place like for teenagers to call you out on something, but you know, to kind of make fun of you. I suppose you can't ever take yourself too serious in the classroom, and you know, I do enjoy building up the relationships and having fun and discussions. I suppose my two languages, you know, English is my other subject, and that allows for an awful lot of discussion and sharing of ideas and thoughts in a classroom. So you get to know the students very, very well, I think, compared to if I was maybe teaching a science, you know, where it's information based, whereas this is getting ideas out of people. So that's, I suppose, my biggest takeaway is I want to be back. I don't want to be at this desk for too much longer. Out of school.
Thank you for describing some of what you learned. I know that's a big task to try and list some of what you learned. I'm curious, because you mentioned your children, what you learned about how this all works when it's happening in one space in terms of work-life balance and parenting and teaching?
Well, I'm very lucky because my two boys were in full-time courses. So they were busy with their own work. My younger boy was living out of home, so he had to come home. And that was a joy, to be honest, because his music is around the house again. And, you know, I mean, I'm delighted that he's away. And, you know, looking for next year, it might happen that college won't happen next year in that, you know, they might have online learning. So will he live away from home? Will it be encouraged? You know, and that's the kind of the college experience lessened a bit too, you know, so you have to think of that. So, I mean, it's been lovely to have them here. We're very, very lucky in that they're very balanced. They're very and very pragmatic. They're older, you know, 19 and 25. So we're not dealing with small children who need to be entertained. Now, but you are managing then kind of disappointments, I suppose, in that calling somebody back from college. You know, now he wasn't called back, but I mean, they all left the house, you know, and he's there with his friends. They're not housemates. They're his friends. Now, they're very lucky in that they do Zooms and they do quizzes and, you know, excuse me. But he was supposed to go interrailing with his friends this summer. That's cancelled. Concerts have been cancelled. On the other hand, I think it's not so bad for everybody because everybody's missing out because nothing's happening. So it's not as if you're missing out because you don't have the money or you're not allowed to go or, you know, so it's just that there's a total shutdown. So that's fine. We're lucky. My husband, there's four of us working in the house, but each one of us has a computer. So each one of us, you know, we're not sharing, we're not looking for time on any device. So we're, you know, as good, we have it as good as it's going to be in a lockdown, to be honest, you know. So, and it's been nice to have everybody home.
I understand. I love the expression you just gave me.
That's too loud, but it is nice.
I understand. And
everybody's safe and well. So, you know, you'll take that.
Yeah. I wondered if you could, for cultural context and social context, explain, because we have a bunch of interlocking narratives here, how has COVID impacted your area ultimately? And how you feel in your own house about the risk, you know, how are you navigating it and how is your city navigating it?
Well, I think our government has handled it really very, very well in that we have almost succeeded in flattening the curve. And that has been huge. We have had, I think, 1,700 and something small deaths in Ireland of COVID, which is amazing. So, you know, and we have had, I think, I know of three people who have had it and three who have survived it. And one is a particularly elderly man who is now hale and hearty, you know, as he's ever going to be. So, we were on lockdown. We had a 2 kilometer radius that we were allowed to leave. We were not allowed. It's only now, tonight is my first time going to see my friends. There will be four of us together. And this is the first time since March, really, that we've seen each other. So it has been restrictive, but calm. Is what I would say. It is very strange. We have been asked to wear face masks when we go out to keep social distancing. And that's strange because you see people out with, you know, with masks. And, you know, it is natural when you see people to shake hands or to hug or something, and that's difficult. I'm hoping next week, we're both from Cork, my husband and I, and we hope next week to go to Cork to see, we haven't seen our parents since February. And that'll be hard to go down and not hug them. You know, so there have been those kind of personal sacrifices, but in the greater scheme of things, they're very minor because everybody's well. And I think every single day, and we have a national broadcaster here, and at every single ad break, we are being reminded of how we're doing, and but we must keep going. And it has been, you know, it has been good, and we've had daily updates from the chief medical officer, which have only stopped in the past week. So we've had daily updates on all sorts of issues. So it's been hard not to see people. That's the hardest thing. But everybody's well. There has been very few deaths in the country, and We're nearly there. You know, we had, I think it was 6 new cases in yesterday in the country, you know, so it's good.
Yeah. And what are you hearing about plans for fall and who is leading you?
My colleague friend who I was on to this morning, she's in charge of timetables in the school. And she has decided, she has a timetable set, but you know, we're working in a vacuum because we don't know what capacity we're going to be able to come have students back. And my husband also is a head of department and he is on timetables, but again, working in a vacuum really, because it will be led by the government and what capacity they say we can have. At the minute, they're looking at about a third capacity. If we look at social distancing, the general class size in my school would be up to 30. If I have 2 meter social distancing, I can have 6 in my room.
So how does that work to accommodate all the students?
We don't know. We don't know. Do we have, you see, it's one thing in the junior section of the school, because they are in one class unit where they go, they all do the same subjects at the same time. So they go from one teacher to another. Whereas when they go into the senior cycle, there are maybe 20 subjects, possibilities, combinations that they can do. So they are going from place to place. So you can't just have the first half of the alphabet in on Monday and the second half on Tuesday, because they're doing different combinations. It wouldn't be possible to follow a timetable. So we don't know. We don't know. We're looking, the conversation at the minute is blended learning.
And blended being?
Online. Online with some FaceTime, I think, some contact, you know.
Can you talk to me about the complexity of both being in a state of waiting and preparing? How do you wait and prepare?
You take a day at a time, a day at a time. We are now on official summer holidays. Our principal wrote to us the other day and said, you are now on official summer holidays. Take your break. Now, you know, you will be preparing because you know what classes you're going to be taking up next year. I suppose you have to prepare for both. You have to prepare your texts. You have to prepare notes, but I think the notes will probably have to be more comprehensive now, because there won't be the chance for a student to ask a question there and then as you're giving them. So it's more, I suppose, really the teacher preparation has to be more comprehensive in that way.
And on site, there are a lot of ways a physical space needs to adapt to some of the new realities. So I'm also taken with the burden for schools to put different exits or entrances or in place while waiting.
Well, yeah, we can do that. However, even our corridor, I laughed with our principal the other day because, you know, he said, how are we going to social distance here? Because if I put my 2 hands out, that is the width of the corridor. It's an old building. It wasn't built. It was built for about 400 students and it has been built upon, you know, added to. But the old part of the building was built for about 400 and we now have over 1,000. So, you know, you can have one-way systems, yes, or entrances and exits, but at the same time, there has to be crossover. The way the school is shaped, there has to be crossover. So I don't know. It is. Now, we all have to partake in COVID training before we go back to work. And there are also some bodies who are doing COVID training for students. So I'll be getting that organized for the students as well for when they go back.
What do you anticipate? I mean, you don't have to, you could also raise questions here as answers, but I'm wondering what you anticipate as student needs if they are able to come back even part-time. What kinds of new needs are you addressing as a result of this experience on top of the usual needs?
Well, there's the need for technology. There will be the need for technological support for students and for some teachers. Some of the teachers I know have been working, would work, we'll say, 100 miles from the school in more rural areas. We're quite rural, but this would be very rural, and would be using their phones as hotspots for their computers. You know, so that kind of, we need, on a national level, we need broadband. For the students, I think some of them will be afraid. You know, you do hear a lot of that at the minute. Our creches are beginning to open up from next week, but as some of the children are afraid to, will be afraid to go back to school. You know, we have got some students who will be vulnerable. We will have asthmatics, you know, different students, kind of immunocompromised. So we'll have to cater for them somehow. We'll also have students who will have lost people due to COVID. You know, they'll have to be talked down somehow or minded, you know, if that is, if we know that they, that's their situation. There was a suggestion with primary schools, because some of the primary schools, if the primary schools closed at the same time, there was a suggestion that the primary school students go back to the same teacher they had up until March, until maybe October. So they go back in September and have 2 months so that they can settle and calm themselves and talk to their teacher who they know and they trust and they love, because they all love their primary teachers. You know, so that was one suggestion made. Now, that was just a public suggestion. It wasn't a politician, but it was made by a teacher, you know. So that's that seems to me to be very logical. We also have a thing here where the students go from sixth class in primary school into first year. And there is usually, at the end of sixth class, they have a transfer program, which continues into first year. So they would have missed out on that as well. Now, a lot of schools at the moment, secondary schools, primary schools and secondary schools, primary schools are saying goodbye to their sixth class students and are doing kind of virtual graduations and doing the transfer. And then the secondary schools are also doing something similar, you know, welcoming students to their school and telling them little bits and pieces about lockers and things. But that is huge as well for the first years coming in. They won't have had that rite of passage and the training for first year that they would have had if they'd stayed in the primary school to the end of the year.
If that suggestion were to be taken seriously, I understand that this was coming from public opinion, but if that suggestion were indulged, which I find very interesting and concrete and sensible, but would even people who'd be moving on go back?
Yeah.
And then shift schools even?
Yes, you would just delay. You would just delay the entry to at the lower level, kind of the kindergarten level of primary school. You would just delay that until October, so that the sixth class students could go do their progression and come into us in the secondary school. We'll say after October midterm. So you're talking about the first week of November, maybe.
But, you know, we have different categories or ways of describing levels, but even students who'd be moving on to, see, we have middle school, would they go back to?
No. So what we have two, we have got primary school, so you're there from about 5 until 12, 13, and then you're in secondary school from 13 to 18, nearly 19. So I suppose the thing about the secondary school is, if we delay the progression, we delay the coursework for those coming up. So if I'm coming out of, we'll say, transition year into fifth year, by October 5th year, I should have a good lot of my coursework done. Whereas if I delay that, I'm missing out on 2 months of coursework then into fifth year. So we can progress and take note of the work. It's more to do with the the psychological well-being, if you like, of the primaries to keep them rather than the secondary school. They're changing with us all the time because we're subject specialists, whereas the primary, it's one teacher they have all of the time. So it's to go back to that one good person that they know and trust to be able to process or to be helped to process what has happened, you know, and that the school might know, you know, the parents will report to schools what situations have been, but you know, out of the mouths of babes, you know, so they'll have their perspective on reality, on their reality as well. So, and it's important to have that heard. And I think a primary teacher is a very good person to be able to do that, to be in that position to do that.
One thing that is, you know, there's an attempt to reconcile these decisions from top down in the United States that I'm aware of, and then to account for all of the individual needs of teachers and students. You mentioned students who are immunocompromised or asthmatics, but teachers also, I'm curious what your own comfort level is. What would you personally like to see happen and feel comfortable with for yourself? You know, what would you imagine wanting to do in 2 months?
I would love to be back in the school, and it's not going, I don't think it's going to happen. Our classes are an hour long, and I know that in times of the cold outbreaks that students get, of course, and we all get kind of in September, October, I actually teach with my door open a lot of the time, windows open, and sometimes I stand at the door and kind of teach inwards, you know, rather than, because, you know, sometimes it's worse than other times. And so I am aware always of a wall, and they will laugh because I say, you are a wall of germs that I... you know, coming at me here, you know, but as I say, they don't mind, you know, they kind of say thanks very much, but that, you know, it doesn't get nasty, or they know it's coming from the right place of having the door open and of minding everybody's health, you know. I'd love to be back. I don't think it's going to happen.
You sound like you're answering from a practical standpoint, but that personally, your anxiety is very low about it for your own risk.
No, I would be very careful, I think, but I know that the school that I'm in will not put me in a place where I don't have to be. They are already looking, and I've sent it on to them, information about training for COVID, for going back to school and to work. Yes, it's a small old build, you know, it's some parts of it are small old building, but the people I work with, my principal and the deputies, are sensible people, and they are very much tuned to our needs as much as to the students' needs. So yes, of course, we serve the community, but at the same time, not at the risk of ourselves. And I think one of the nuns in the school is at the minute making face masks for the front lines. And one of our technology teachers is making shields. And I think he's probably going to make shields for all of us. So I know I'm not going to be asked to be in any position that I'm not going to be comfortable with. So I am comfortable with what's in place. So I suppose I can not relax, but you know, I can come at it from that angle. I know my principal is not going to make me go into a classroom, and I'm certainly, my job won't be in jeopardy if I say, listen, on this day, this is how it is. So no, or that, you know, she's got the sniffles and she's sitting there in front of me, you know. So there is very good training for COVID, and very good guidelines on COVID rooms, escape rooms, if you like. So if somebody does come with symptoms during the day, that there will be rooms set aside for them until they're collected, you know. So there'll be procedures in place.
So even hearing about that contingency plan, how has that been communicated to you? Has this been casual conversation between colleagues, or has there been communication about plans?
No, sorry, I would be in on the planning for this. So maybe that's why I would be calmer about it. Because my students, as program coordinator, I get an awful lot of proposals from companies from different areas, and one of them would be, of course, first aid. And there's an awful lot of first aid courses on at the minute for my students going out onto work shadowing or community service. Okay, so and they are then doing more online services as well for people going back to work. So I have sent all of that on to the deputy principal, who'd be, you know, in charge of the procurement of that kind of course. So I suppose I'd be in the planning position for that. So there's a lot out there. The government has been very good, I have to say, on different aspects of going back to work, and they have got a policy document as well on going back to work already, because places are opening up now, and it's mandatory that every worker does this training before going back to work.
So now you're really helping me get a picture of your own position, and what I'm hearing, if I'm hearing correctly, is that you have trust in your leadership at school, in your government, and you have agency because you're actually involved in the planning. So you're not going to just be told what to do. You're going to have a voice in that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. But also, I do know that even before we closed down, teachers who were vulnerable were sent home. So I suppose is where my confidence comes from, you know, and that's it. And even, you know, when we were going in to collect equipment or books or that from the school, there were protocols in place from the very beginning. So the school was closed down for a while, then we were allowed to go, and this was all on a government timetable. We were allowed to go to schools from, I think, the 18th of May, to go to schools to get more teaching and learning materials or equipment that we needed. But there were absolute protocols in place that we had to book our time slot for entering the school, you know, hand hygiene, et cetera, et cetera. So all of that was in place. So yes, I do trust the leadership team in the school, definitely.
I think it's helpful to hear how much of that impacts people's personal levels of anxiety around around COVID and returning. What questions, I want to be mindful of our agreed upon time and some of the, you know, last questions I just want to invite you to address are, you know, first of all, anything you'd like to put on the record at this point that hasn't come up yet, either as something you don't want to forget about this very unique time, so a record for yourself, or a question, you know, anything that hasn't come up yet?
No, I think I've said kind of what I feel you're interested in, you know, in that the questions that you've asked or that you followed up on what I've said. I think I've said what I would like to say. No, I think I'm okay.
In thinking about being in any kind of informal dialogue with a small group of educators, are there questions you have that you want to discuss in a collegial peer way if you were to be in dialogue?
Well, it would be interesting to see what way other schools or sectors are taking the go back to school situation, the scenario, and also maybe what tools they might be using to teach their classes, you know, and what they find useful, or what, you know, not tips and tricks, but, you know, things that they might, you know, online tools or that there might be in services there somewhere, you know, that might just be very useful.
Okay, that's helpful to hear. So both models for returning and also tools for online education and dealing with even a blended classroom. Okay, and is there anything else that you want to make sure you either elaborate upon or introduce?
No, I don't think so, no.
This has been extremely helpful, and it's been wonderful to start this project with someone who's really enmeshed in another educational system, because I took nothing for granted in terms of understanding, and that was helpful to me. So thank you for explaining some of the things that anyone in your country would already know.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
What we would like to do is put you into dialogue with other educators, and also would love to re-interview you, because what we're interested in charting are plans and realities, and also really moving through student needs. Right now I'm really hearing about teachers' needs and educators' needs, but I'm curious, you know, once students are back, what we're going to be hearing from the learners.
Okay. Yep.
Well, thank you so much. I will be in touch. Is there anything about the release form that when I stop the recording you'd like to go over now?
Well, I'll have a quick look at it and just, it's the yeses or noes really.
Okay. Well, why don't I stop the recording and then you and I can talk about that list. And yep. I want to thank you so much, Orla.
Thank you very much.